Imagine two snakes lying side by side. These are very long snakes, so long in fact that they stretch around the length of the globe. And though they lie next to each other parallel, every few miles they become entangled. Long, black, sinewy muscles covered in scales, intertwined to the point that you can no longer tell where one snake begins and the other ends. And there, the beginning point and the ending point, one snake's tail is in the other snake's mouth. And likewise. One snake's name is religion. The other snake's name is philosophy.
Welcome to God, the podcast. I am your host, God, not the God of the Bible, not a long-haired old man up in the sky, but rather the peace of God that inhabits all of us, that connects us all in the human family, connects us to every blade of grass, every living thing on this planet. That's the God that I am. I'm just that little piece of him. Like I said, welcome to God the Podcast. We are coming to you live from the wooded glade where we record this. If you listen closely, you can hear a babbling brook in the background, and birds singing, and forest creatures chittering along as I speak. This week, we are interviewing Pete Fossil, who is the philosophy professor at Transylvania University here in Lexington, Kentucky. We're really excited to have that conversation with him. We talk about philosophy and its connection to theology and religion and God and all of those things. And Pete had a lot to say about a lot of topics, and he set me straight on some stuff that I was maintaining some amateurish, uninformed opinions about, so I appreciate Pete doing that. Before we get into it, there was something I thought I should address. Now, you're listening to this courtesy of the Breadbox Network, Breadbox Media, and you may be aware Breadbox Media is a Catholic podcast network. And so the question you might rightfully ask yourself is, Patch, are you Catholic yourself? And the answer to that question is no. In any conventional sense, I am not Catholic. And what do I mean by conventional sense? Well, I do. I like liturgies. I enjoy a nice liturgy. I'm in favor of men wearing big hats and dresses. But beyond, like, those are the two things about me that are pretty Catholic. Outside of that, there's nothing about me that is Catholic. I was not raised Catholic. I'm not converted to Catholicism. I have some friends who are Catholic. Some of my best friends are Catholic. I don't really see religion, so I don't notice they're Catholic, but I'm told they're Catholic. But anyway, I have some friends who are Catholic, and lots of respect for them and what they do, but I am not Catholic myself. I don't really use anything to describe where I stand religiously very often. Sometimes I've been known to call myself a pagan or a pantheist, or in the tradition of Joseph Campbell, I've said a rational transcendentalist, and that's probably the closest to what I am. But if you were to ask me what that means exactly, I'd have a hard time really describing it to you. So anyway, not a Catholic, but happy to be here on their network. And I think the stuff that I talk about, the stuff that I have to say and my guests have to say, is very beneficial and useful to Catholics. So I hope you won't let the fact that I'm not one of you guys deter you from listening. I think there's something very valuable here that you can gain regardless in the spirit of interfaith conversation. Not that I'm of a faith. I mean, we're all of a faith. We won't get into the semantics of that now. Not when we have Peter Fossil to listen to, a philosophy professor from Transylvania University, a philosopher, economist. I forget what else. It's been a long time since I did this recording, but he chose all the hard professions he could, and he was like, give me that. I want more of that. But we talked about that in the episode, so I'll quit talking and we'll... Welcome to God the Podcast. This is our third episode, and today our guest is Peter Fossil. I've been calling you Peter. Is it Peter or Pete? Or Peter or Pete?
I told my brother it's funny if I knew when as a kid people called me Pete. But Pete or Peter's fine.
Yeah. Okay. I think you can tell a lot about a person by what they write about themselves on their Facebook page. And I loved that on your Facebook page it said philosopher. No credentials, no explanation of that. And so I really appreciate that. I like that. But I know there probably are credentials, so give us those. Tell us who you are and what you do.
Yeah, well, one reason I don't put Transylvania on there, I'm the chair of philosophy of Transylvania, University in Lexington, and but I try to keep my Facebook persona separate from my professional persona. So I try to never discuss the, like, professional things.
That way
on Facebook.
You can say whatever you want that way.
Exactly. So I'm the chair of philosophy and also philosophy, politics, and economics, which is a different major at Trans. It's like an interdisciplinary major.
Okay.
And I'm the editor of an academic journal called Cogent Arts and Humanities.
Okay. So philosophy, economics, and politics. Are you allergic to easy stuff? Is that the problem?
Yeah, it's something like that. That's what my wife would say. I went to grad school at Emory down in Atlanta. I did undergrad work at Bucknell, Pennsylvania. I grew up near Philadelphia in a steel town. And I also did some of my schooling at the London School of Economics and the University of Edinburgh.
Okay, so good pedigree there. So this podcast seeks to kind of talk about God a little bit and the different ways people perceive God and think about God and different paths to transcendence. So as a person who's one of your large focuses is philosophy, you know, one of the questions I kind of asked you last night as we were talking about this was, if philosophy were a circle and theology were a circle, can you make a Venn diagram, and how big is the overlap in those two subjects?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. So it's kind of all a matter of definition, as it often is in all these things, trying to define the concepts. And people do use concepts like theology and philosophy differently. You know, for instance, so some people will just talk about a philosophy just being like a system of beliefs. So like your philosophy of this, or somebody has a philosophy of that, or everybody has a philosophy. Whereas some others use it in a more technical way to think about a specific body of intellectual work with a certain tradition, a certain set of methods, things like that. And same with theology. I mean, in some ways you could say every religion has a theology. On the other hand, I think in a more precise way, theology is a sort of a philosophical attempt to come to terms with fundamental concepts in religion. So, and by that definition, and I typically think of it that way, it's a sort of subset of philosophy where I guess you said how much an extent. It's hard for me to say that geographically, but not a huge extent. So there's a lot of other philosophy besides theology. But it's the attempt to. So if you think about, here's the way I sometimes might describe it with students would be that when, say, you know, Christianity got going, it wasn't in this sense theological. It took until the Roman era, maybe around especially the 4th century and then the development of the Nicene Creed and that whole period when they're doing all these early councils of bishops and theologians and trying to work out. They brought Greek and Roman philosophy to bear on Christianity, and that's when Christian theology really got going. If you use it in that more philosophical sense, and I realize other people might use theology in a different sense, but that's what I'd say. It's this attempt to come up with a systematic, abstract, theoretical interpretation and clarification of religious concepts and practices.
Okay. Are you and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, are you a religious man yourself?
Well, I belong to the Quakers.
Okay.
And I guess I consider myself a friend, but not a very good Quaker. And I don't practice all that much anymore. And I'll tell you, one of the reasons I was drawn to Quakerism, in fact, was its emphasis on silence rather than theology. They started in Catholicism, which is highly theological. In fact, I would say it was Catholicism that got me into philosophy.
Okay.
But then actually, you know, I kind of left behind the theological side of it and went more to a posture of silence about, you know, theological issues. And I liked that about the Quakers. So, again, I would call myself a skeptical Quaker, or a Quakerly skeptic. Maybe that's a better term, a Quakerly skeptic.
Okay. Okay. So when you say, when you talk about Quakers and you say silence, is that silence in the sense of they just don't really talk about theology, or silence in the sense of mindfulness? Practice silence.
That's a great question. So, I mean, there's all kinds of Quakers, as you probably know, and some have pretty traditional meetings for worship where there's a pastor and a sermon and that sort of thing. Others, the sort of branch that I've been associated with and belong to, at a Quaker meeting, people just sit there in silence. Now, there is a theological background that's beyond the silence, whereas there was this idea, you know, that Quakers started in the 1600s, and there was this idea of the priesthood of the believer that Lutherans were very into and Quakers were into as well. That was the idea that, you know, one could have kind of direct revelation and personal revelations. And what one did was one sat in silence, in a gathered silence, they like to say. And when one felt moved by the Spirit to speak, one would communicate what one thought, you know, what one had intuited or what had been revealed to one. So a lot of Quakers will think about that as, like, you sit around until you feel moved by the divine to say something, and then you say it. And so everybody, in a way, is sort of a pastor, or anybody can speak the truth, and the rest of us, then you sit there and you listen to it and try to reflect on it for a while and come to it. But I actually like the strict silence, in the sense that, I mean, this gets, you know, pretty complicated pretty quickly, but I'm not sure that matters of the divine can really be put into language, at least language as it's often thought of. So, you know, at least the way theologians try to approach it, as I was describing before, in terms of having a sort of theoretical, logically consistent, abstract theory of God or the divine or you know, related concepts. I think maybe those can't be expressed linguistically in the way that a lot of people try to, or theologians have tried to. Now, you could look at, and I do kind of, this one way, in fact, I still really respect Catholics, is, you know, you could look at the liturgy and even theology maybe somewhat as a kind of poem, as a kind of poetry that's not trying to be scientific, it's not trying to be to state true and false, clear propositions in the same way one would propositions about you know, the material universe, or about you know, the facts of the world, or something like that.
So it's more of a reaction. Liturgy is reaction. So I'm not trying to tell you about something about God. I'm just reacting to how God makes me feel in this moment.
Yeah, well, not... Well, I mean, that's one way I suppose you could interpret it, in terms of, like, just having emotional... It's sort of an expression of an emotional response. But here's the other thing that maybe is a bit more than that. It might be the case that some things are expressible in poetry that are truths, that are kind of, you know, insights or understandings that can't be expressed in other forms of language.
Okay, you're totally ringing my bell right now. I'm a big Joseph Campbell guy. And, and Joseph Campbell would say that God is the ultimate truth and can't be expressed. And so the reason culture has used mythology is because mythology is a penultimate truth. So it's just below truth, and so it's a way to actually talk about the things of God.
Exactly. I mean, we're congruent in that way. I mean,
awesome.
I was saying, talk about poetry, but I mean, mythology could fit in there too, in the same way, yeah. That distinction between the mythos and logos.
Yeah. So I've been, here's a thing that I've been thinking about a lot that I'm glad to be on a FaceTime with a philosophy guy, because this is a question I really want to dig into here. So Nietzsche famously said, God is dead. And we never quote the rest of that. The rest of it is to say, I believe, and you correct me here, God is dead, we killed him. And to paraphrase, there will never be enough water to wash the blood off our hands. And so then he went ahead to kind of predict all the bloodshed of the 20th century. And so the way I interpret that is he's making a point that our ethics, our morality, has a metaphysical core to it. And when you try to take that core out of it, which has largely been the work of the 20th century with science and nihilism and things like that, when you try to take that metaphysical core out of it, it kind of falls apart. Now, I don't necessarily see that as Nietzsche arguing for the existence of God, but more the necessity of belief or the necessity of mythology, like we were just talking about. When we underpine what we do with some sort of belief structure, some sort of mythology, it gives it meaning. When you take that meaning away, it can potentially erode. Correct me, knock me around. Tell me what I've got wrong.
I mean, I'm not here to correct.
Well, give me your point of view, I guess.
My point of view is, well, I mean, notice that you went from metaphysics to mythology, and that's where I would say maybe I think I'd be a little bit reluctant to follow you in terms of interpreting Nietzsche. I think Nietzsche was glad that God, in the sense that he was talking about, was dead, and you're right that there was this problematic aftermath, but that might be overcomable for him in terms of a new kind of person,
the Uberman. Yeah.
That's right. So that's what's going to be required to overcome that that stain, because I think Nietzsche's sort of issue was kind of complaining about theology and metaphysics in the sense that what had he thought had happened was that both Platonism and Christianity, both, and it probably would include Islamic theology in this too, but had devalued this world in favor of a transcendent world, a higher world. And what had happened was we were no longer able to love and value this world unless we saw it as rooted somehow in the upper world. But then what happened, because of a kind of skeptical stream in our civilization, was people were no longer able to really believe in that upper world, as you said. I mean, this kind of skeptical nihilism, you know.
So it was postmodernism, kind of.
Exactly. But, so that left us, so once you then kill God, meaning you kill that upper world, you destroy that upper world, that transcendent realm, then the world that had been devalued without it is now without value. And so we're left with a world that's meaningless and senseless without value. But the problem there was that metaphysics had sucked all the value out of it at the beginning. So his strategy, I think, was to try to restore value to this world without rooting it in upper world. So I think, you know, his gesture was just the opposite. It was to refuse the move to the transcendent and to return value here. But the thing that you and I might agree on still is, you know, it's like, just take out, forget metaphysics and just talk about mythos, that I think, you know, that it might be the case that the attempt to understand the world in strictly scientific, literal, straightforward true and false propositions might also lead to nihilism, and that you need to have a kind of mythos underneath it all, and that mythos, or that, you know, poetic basis to the world, that imaginative, poetic way of engaging the world is really something that where religion might have a place, and where you know, value can be restored to the world, and morality and all that sort of thing.
Interesting. Do you believe in a collective unconscious, which would be, Joseph Campbell would argue that mythology is informed, that we all, when we dream, if we dream in a mythic state, we see the same archetypes appearing over and over again. Is there something to that, do you think?
You know, I've not really been down that road too much. I, you know, as a skeptic, Skeptics don't say things are false. They'll just say, like, they don't know. It's like,
yeah, you
know,
yeah.
Let's suspend judgment on it. And that's the difference. An atheist says, you know, God doesn't exist. A skeptic just says, I'm just suspending judgment on the questions. I don't really know.
Yeah.
But, and I'm sort of, I probably would go down that route. I mean, you know, there's this big debate, really, in philosophy for a long time still about whether there are universal truths and whether there is anything universally human or universal to our consciousness. You know, I think probably the old way of thinking about that doesn't work, but I have been on the side of a kind of universalism that I work on called what I've been calling skeptical universals, but as far as a collective unconsciousness, maybe. I just don't know. I just don't know.
Well, that's safe ground to stake out to say, yeah. I don't know. So I'm with you on that. So I've stated myself as a Joseph Campbell guy. So he really influences a lot of the way I think about religion and transcendence. Do you, as a philosopher, who are your guys? Whose camp do you fall in? Who are you inspired by?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Well, I mean, my big guy is David Hume, who was a skeptic.
Yeah, okay.
And he was kind of criticized as being the great infidel, and he's not a great friend of religion, it's true. And so my skepticism is deeply informed by Hume. I have had some influence from Nietzsche, I suppose, but also this guy named Wittgenstein, and he really influenced me about the idea of silence. And he was very much about the limits of language and what one could say and what one couldn't say in a meaningful way, and sort of being conscious of that and not trying to say things that maybe can't be said. Then the other one, maybe Heidegger, Martin Heidegger, yeah. Who also had a lot to say about silence and poetry. He thought that the fundamental nature of human existence really was best approached through silence and poetry, and that influenced me. Maybe the last one I say is this guy named Stanley Cavell, and that's what I still get a kind of sense of nature and universals, because Cavell sort of taught me how there might be a way to approach kind of deep unity and commonality among human beings that is not through, it's more poetic and non-scientific.
Okay. You've mentioned poetry a lot. Are you a poet? Or do you try?
It's funny. I aspire to it. I'm thinking about it. I'm starting a leave of absence now. I'm thinking about starting recording some poetry.
Awesome.
I've not been. But it's funny you say that, because I've become more and more over the course of my career conscious of the importance of language and the power of language and trying to, like, attend to language when I write. I think more about the logical, you know, dimensions of what I was working on. You know, is it consistent? Is it clear? Is it, you know, justified? These kinds of things, you know. But now I'm much more into the rhetoric of it. So I'm moving in that direction, but I'm not a poet.
Well, it sounds like you should give it a shot.
I want to.
Okay. So you mentioned Hume as your big guy. So if somebody's wanting to dip their foot in those waters, where's the best place to start with Hume?
To start? Especially if you're interested in religion, I would say he has a little book called Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion.
Okay.
And I would start there. And it's a dialogue between all these characters about whether or not you can know God, really.
Okay.
And, whether or not you can have arguments and proofs about the existence and nature of God. After that, I would probably send you to a little book called The Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. So those are the two places I would go.
Okay, those are good training wheels to push off with. Okay.
Yeah.
There's this guy that does a podcast, his name's Lewis Howes, and he always asks his guest, if you could put up a billboard with one thing that you want the world to see, like that kind of encapsulates your point of view. I won't steal his billboard idea, but I will use it to preface the question. Is if you could leave listeners with one nugget, what kind of sums up you and your teaching and your philosophy?
Yeah. Be skeptical and appreciate your finitude.
Okay, that's good. The appreciation of finitude, I assume pushes
your
you. It makes everyday mean more because you realize it could be your last.
Yeah, and I also think that really one of the biggest problems that we face in the world is that people want to speak and think as if they know absolute truths and that they've proven what they think they've said, and that I think the world would be a better place if people were more skeptical in the sense that they realize that because they're finite human beings, that their capacity to know things, to say things clearly, to understand things is extremely limited. You know, so there's kind of self-knowledge to it. I mean, philosophy has often been about the project of self-knowledge. For me, one of the results of a kind of scrutiny of self has been an appreciation of how limited I am in knowing and understanding the world and even myself. And so, you just hear people say all these things about, you know, I know this about the economy, I know this about God's will, I know this about, you know, moral truth, I know this about, and then they're willing to go out and, you know, kill other people on the basis of that knowledge. And I think we'd be a little bit better off if we all thought to ourselves, you know, maybe I really don't know. My father used to say, he was a devout Catholic, he used to say, you know, every religion thinks they know God best, but I'm not sure any of them did. And I think that sort of attitude might help us a lot more. I mean, it doesn't say don't go out and have, you know, religion or have your faith, but appreciate you're just a little bug and, you know, you might not have it right, and maybe somebody else has it right. Probably shouldn't be out there slaughtering other people because they have a different opinion from yours.
You've got to share this planet with a lot of other little bugs, so...
Yeah, that's right. That's
good. So I had set that up to be my last question, but then you said one thing that got my brain going. Self-awareness. It seems like there are a lot of people that lack self-awareness, and it seems like it is the antidote to a lot of problems. As a philosopher, do you have suggestions on how to cultivate self-awareness?
Oh, you really put me up on a soapbox. Like, not only do I am a philosophy professor, but I'm a humanities professor. And I really think another, you know, thing that would really help our world is if people studied the humanities more, read the humanities more. It includes poetry, music, literature. Those things cultivate self-understanding. So does chemistry, and so does engineering. Well, maybe engineering does. I don't know. Maybe business. I don't know. You know, but I think really, you know, a world where you get technical knowledge about how to do things and how to build things and how to make money is a nihilistic world without the self understanding that we get in the humanities, and that includes the study of religion, by the way, too. So, I think. We, you know, our civilization, one of the perils that I see in our world is people pulling back from humane engagements with literature. They look at them as luxuries, as entertainment, as, leisure activities, but... Really, I think it's the most important thing that we do is engage the work of self-understanding that people in the humanities have undertaken.
That was good. Not a lot of people would have an answer to that question, so I appreciate that. Well, Peter Mann, thank you so much for this. I have a direction I want this thing to go, but at the same time, the direction is informed by the people that I meet and the things they say to me. And so, if I could have planned this episode, it would have been terrible. Like, if I had said, okay, Peter, here's what you're going to say, and right. It would have just been a mirror of my poor understandings of things. So I appreciate the interest and the insight that you brought to my questions. So thanks, man.
Well, you're a great interviewer, and you're a lot of fun to talk to, and I look forward to listening to or watching your podcast as it develops and grows.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks, Peter.
Bye, Patrick.
Good to have you. Bye-bye. So that was it. It was our interview with Pete Fossil.
hope you enjoyed it. New episode next week. See you then. Thanks.